From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that is accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally. This morning, we talk with award-winning business professor Andrew Brodsky about ways to make the most out of interacting digitally and practical strategies for navigating virtual communication in his new book, Ping, The Secrets of Successful Virtual Communication. Then we talk with author Faisal Haq about how to unlock AI's full potential while also protecting what is most precious about the human experience, and how AI can unlock untold human potential and his new book, Transcend, Unlocking Humanity in the Age of AI. Stay with us. We'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
It seems that most of our communication these days is conducted via Zoom or email or text. And many of us are giving up or have already given up on trying to have a meaningful or professional conversation virtually. But there are ways to make the most out of communication technology and practical strategies for navigating these pathways. Joining us to share these tools is Andrew Brodsky. He is the author of the new book, Ping, The Secrets of Successful Virtual Communication. Andrew is an award-winning business professor and expert in virtual communication at the University of Texas at Austin, and has dedicated his career to unraveling the intricacies of virtual communication. Andrew, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, so many of us might think that we aren't using that much virtual communication. No, most of my communication is done in the old analog way, not digitally. But as the three of us sit here on a Zoom call this morning, I think that just reinforces that digital communication is everywhere. Tell us about all the areas that we find ourselves communicating virtually.
I actually recently saw a survey that indicated people check their emails and instant messages about once every 6 minutes at work. So people are constantly connected. And it's not just about people who work remotely. Even in the office now, when people are just 2 feet away from each other, they're sending an instant message or a Slack message instead of just going and knocking on their office door or cubicle or going over to them. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, because the old way was you'd always interrupt someone every time you had a question. Now people have the ability to answer those messages more at their convenience, so their work's not interrupted. So this is happening everywhere, both work and life.
Well, and I know that yesterday I was working on a project and my phone kept pinging, and it was so nice to turn it off and to know that those messages will be there when I'm able to focus. But what are we missing out on when we just put everything aside, whether it's locking the office door so people can't come in, or we turn our notifications off?
So there's always trade-offs. One of the things that can happen is maybe someone has an important piece of information for you that would really speed up what you're doing at the moment. Or maybe you're going on, for instance, you're going on a date or something, and you're just not checking your phone because you don't want to see those work messages. But the person messaged you, hey, I'm going to be 2 hours late. Or they message you a piece of information that's related to your work that would have saved you a ton of time, and you didn't see it because you put it to side. So there are disadvantages potentially by not constantly looking. That said, multitasking is one of the worst things you can do for your attention. So the trick is finding the right balance between being communicative, seeing your communication, but not constantly having yourself interrupted all the time.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Andrew Brodsky digitally via Zoom. We're talking about the secrets of successful virtual communication in his new book, Ping. Now, Andrew, you have a really great personal story that gives you so much more credibility than those of us who started communicating virtually, you know, about 2020. Well, that is during our workday, 100%, but you have been communicating that way for a long time. How so?
When I was 16 years old, I was diagnosed with a rare case of leukemia, and it required a bone marrow transplant. And as part of this bone marrow transplant when I was 16, I spent over a month in one of these isolation rooms where everyone who comes in has to wear gowns, gloves, masks. And even when I wasn't in the isolation room, my immune system was very weakened. So I spent almost a year or two back in high school, long before everyone else had their experience with COVID lockdowns, having to interact with others from a distance. And for me, the question became, well, how can I do this better? What works, what doesn't? So when I began my PhD at Harvard Business School, that seemed like a good opportunity to conduct my research on, to understand how can we make these distant interactions more useful. And also as a result of my treatment, which obviously I survived and did great on, I did end up with an immune deficiency. So I'm still having to often be more thoughtful about, do I go in person, do I not? So for me, helping others to do this better seemed really valuable.
Yeah, so most of us have come to our techniques of deciding whether it's going to be a meeting, an email, an instant message or whatever via, you know, just anecdotally what seems to work best for us. But you've actually done, you know, scientific research into that. How does one conduct scientific research into this question of successful virtual communication?
That's a great question. And at this point, I've done research on over 500,000 people. I studied over 48 million interactions, and there's a variety of different approaches to this. So there are lab studies where you basically bring people into the lab at the university, or you recruit them online, and you could do experiments where maybe you have some interact via audio only, some via video and audio, some via just text chat, and see how outcomes differ. Additionally, there's also field studies where basically I get these huge data sets from companies that track all the different types of interactions their employees have had. And I can match that to different relevant outcomes to see, okay, this is more effective than that, or that's more effective than this. And under which conditions are things better versus not? So there's a bunch of different approaches that have been taken to studying this topic.
Andrew, how do we ensure that our true, I don't say personality, but our true like essence comes through in these conversations? Like we'll get in a family text thread and sometimes they're really funny, but then let's say I need to jump off. So I either just do a one word goodbye or I don't say anything. And everyone, you know, like, well, where did you go? And it wasn't a personal thing. I was just busy. And we lose, I think if I feel like we lose a lot of our own personalities as we're communicating virtually. I mean, like we get to see you right now on the Zoom call. So it's nice to see you and that we smile and we interact. But otherwise, how do we ensure that ourselves, our true selves come through?
You hit on a number of points there with related to authenticity, level of communication. So let's focus on the authenticity one. I actually did a set of studies with managers, negotiators, and a set of 11 international schools in Vietnam, where I studied parent-teacher interactions. And the goal of the study was to understand what mode is best for seeming most authentic. Is it the richer modes like video or in person? Should we do less rich like text? When's best? So there are two core findings. The first one is if you're truly being authentic, so you're truly feeling what you're trying to express, the richer mode is better. So you want to have video, you want to do in person, because that authenticity can shine through. But there's a second set of findings. And that's related to the fact that oftentimes we want to try to be authentic, but we aren't necessarily. So maybe your best friend just got engaged, but you were in a fight with your spouse in the morning. So like you're really stressed. It wouldn't be appropriate for you to go to your best friend saying, sorry, I can't be happy for you. I'm stressed about an argument I had this morning. You need to congratulate them and seem happy. And at work, it's service with a smile. We're always expected to be happy at work, no matter if someone's being mean to us, or if we had a lot of traffic in the morning and we're stressed or whatever. So this is called surface acting, what researchers call it, which is the idea where you're trying to show you're authentic, but may not be. And it can be for the benefit of the person. And what I found in these studies was that for surface acting, people tended to choose email because it felt it was safest. It would hide their nonverbal behavior so nothing could leak through. But that was the wrong choice. The best choice ended up being audio interactions. It was a sweet spot because audio interactions mask a lot of the nonverbal behaviors from face-to-face and video. So you don't have to worry about grimacing or accidentally looking away or looking down. But the thing where email backfired is it seemed so low effort. It seemed like you didn't care, whereas audio just seems so much more thoughtful and effortful. So it's a sweet spot where it doesn't seem low effort like email, but it hides all those things you're trying to hide really well. So audio interactions are often overlooked and can be one of the best for when you're trying to engage in this type of authenticity.
I have a few friends and we still keep our communications via good old-fashioned phone calls. And it's really nice to have that phone ring. And even if I'm busy, it's like, oh, I'm going to answer this. All right, well, let's talk about emojis and these other ways of trying to add emotion or reaction into, like, specifically text messages, because I'm not a big fan, but sometimes you just got to throw that one laughing emoji in. What do you think about emojis?
Emojis are one of the big questions I always get from just everyone, students, executives, you name it. And the research on it is that there's fairly mixed outcomes. So sometimes they can make you seem warmer. Sometimes they can make you seem less competent. So there's pros and cons, and there's not a good overarching rule. The overarching rule I generally recommend, though, is related to something called language mimicry. So the idea here is if the other person uses emojis, you use emojis. If they use exclamation marks, you use exclamation marks. If they use certain kind of jargon, you do it too. The reason for this is that we tend to trust people who are similar to us. So when someone communicates like us, we feel like we can understand them a little bit better. Plus, we all think we're great communicators. So when someone else communicates like us, we're like, well, they are a good communicator too. The only note about this is don't go overboard. If you're playing a game of Simon Says where you're copying everything they're doing, that's really gonna backfire. So you wanna be subtle about it. But the idea is rather than trying to guess what's best, take your cues from the other person.
So instead of using 5 exclamation points, maybe we just tone it down to 1 or 2 to answer.
Unless the other person uses 5 exclamation marks, then maybe you might want to use 3 at least to show that you're reciprocating the excitement in the way that they understand.
Yeah, it's funny about communicating excitement. And we all, I think, try to do that in various ways. I think that I sometimes, well, I have to go back through, say, a text message and erase several exclamation points because I go overboard on the exclamation points. And also, sometimes I'll craft a message and it doesn't have a very friendly tone. It's just business. So I go back to the beginning, and this is maybe where what you'd say is overcrafting comes in. I'll start with a little phrase like, hey, how's it going? Hope you're well. Then the business. Is that overcrafting or what is?
Overcrafting is an interesting topic. Many people think about meetings are a waste of time at work. You know, you spend hours and hours doing them. What they miss is that email could be a real waste of time too, or text messages. For instance, the conversation we're all having right now. You're asking me a lot of questions. I'm talkative. I answer with a few paragraphs. If I were to do this via email, you were to email me these questions, it would probably take me days to write up the answers. But because we're talking live, we're only going to talk for maybe half an hour. So when you start getting to the point where you start feeling more anxious and you're not really improving it, that's when you want to take a step back and say, you know what, I should probably just send this. And one of the things people don't realize is that you tend to think about your communication a lot more than the other person does. To you, this may seem like the most important email, text message, whatever of all time, but think about you as a recipient. If you're like me, you're across a week, you're probably getting well over 100 emails, instant messages, text messages, having lots of meetings. How much do you really remember everything that everyone said? And the answer is probably not that much. So we tend to be very self-focused. That's not to say it doesn't matter, because you can have additive effects based on the quality of your communication. So it's important to do well. But if you're super, super stressed about something, about something minor in a message, there's a good chance the other person is not going to be nearly as attentive to it as you are.
Yeah, well, that brings up a question for me surrounding tone. The messages that I labor over are, did I get the correct tone? So are you saying that the correct tone isn't really as important?
So tone is actually one of the more important things. So there's 2 pieces of advice with this. One, you want to err on the side of being a little extra positive, because virtual interactions tend to just come off a little bit more negative. And people who are anxious on the receiving side or angry on the receiving side, they tend to fill in those gaps with their own information. So there's a risk that it may come off worse than you intended. The other piece of advice comes from research on emotion in email. And when we write an email, the emotion tends to be very clear in our heads. We can hear the emotion as we're writing it, So it seems obvious what emotion is in there. But what these researchers found is that people overestimated the likelihood that someone would actually understand their emotion, and they had a solution. Their solution was take the message you wrote, read it out loud in the opposite tone you intended. So if it's serious, read it as sarcastic. If it's sarcastic, read it as serious. And when people did that, they suddenly realized, oh, wait, the tone of my message isn't as clear as I intended. So in that case, that's a good way to get around the, is this as obvious as I think it is? And if you can't get around that, I suggest maybe trying to say, hey, can we have a quick phone call or a quick meeting? Just want to discuss something. If you're concerned, it's really going to go sideways.
Andrew, I think you bring up a good point that we don't have to immediately respond to these things. I mean, if we're in a conversation with somebody, you know, in an analog way, we will take the time to sit and think, and that's okay. But I feel like sometimes you're just under pressure. I have to get right back to them, especially if it's a text or even some emails. But how do we make sure that we can step back and take the time? Is it just being more cognizant of the fact that they don't need an immediate response?
There's actually a name for the effect you just talked about. Researchers have titled it the email urgency bias. And I talk about it in my book, Ping. And it's the idea that when you send me an email, I think, wow, these are, you know, some very important hosts here. They probably want a response within 30 minutes. But reality on the recipient side, you're like, I don't care if he gets back to me for a few days. And the issue is that this misestimate of how quickly you need to respond creates a lot of stress. It makes us feel they need to be attached to our phones all the time, constantly checking because we're concerned the person wants a quick response. So the first step is realize that you probably think they want a response quicker than they actually do. But what can be better, especially for people you interact with regularly, is to have those explicit conversations and be like, hey, how quickly do we normally expect people to respond to emails versus text message versus instant message? And what these researchers found in their study is that when people put just a note at the end of their email that said, it'd be great if you could get back to me within X days or by X time, it reduces stress very significantly related to this urgency need of having to respond quickly. So just being more explicit about expectations can really help just make people feel better and eliminate that stress.
Well, this might date myself, maybe even Lynn. My expectations for myself when I send out messages, especially text messages, is I like to have proper punctuation, and I will feel bad if I leave off a period at the end of a sentence. Is that an age thing, or what are the expectations of proper punctuation and grammar in these communication methods?
It's definitely going to depend on the context. So if you're writing a thank you email to someone who interviewed you, you don't want to flub the punctuation. If you're texting with a friend, the norms may be that, you know, punctuation isn't needed. And sometimes having, you know, the exact right punctuation and language can make it seem too formal and like you're not really in a good relationship. You could imagine the type of email you would send to a new customer or to someone who interviewed you is going to be very formal. If you were to use that language with a friend, it's going to be like, this person must not really like me. They say like, dear Katie, it is with great regret that I cannot attend, you know, our meeting today. You're going to be looking at them weird. And the same thing kind of happens with punctuation if you're being overly formal about it. But again, you should consider what cues the other person is using. You want to mimic what they're doing. So if they're being pretty casual with their conversation, that's something good for you to do. If there's someone who is super intense about their grammar and punctuation, you might want to be a little more attentive to that as well.
Andrew, I think we would be remiss if we didn't bring up the topic of AI and how increasingly we're using that in forms of communication. And so you have kind of developed some guidelines, and I'm just curious what you think about it overall as a communicator, as a digital communicator.
So AI, this is pretty much where I end my book, because it's the idea is where we're going in the future. And my view on it is that there will always be a value to the human component of communication. The thing is, many times someone may not realize you're using AI to communicate, whether you're copying and pasting email from an AI chatbot, or maybe you're reading a pre-prepared script during a video call. The problem is they're going to realize once every so often. Maybe the AI uses words you don't normally use, like prolific or elevated or whatever else. Or maybe we talked about something, about maybe, you know, the previous weekend, you mentioned that you were in a car accident or something. And then you copy and paste an AI email to this person and says, I hope you had a great weekend, exclamation mark. And it completely missed the fact that you talked about something in person, because AI will never know everything that's in your head. And so there's this real risk that once someone will figure out that you're using AI to communicate with them, but just that one time will cause them to question every single interaction you've had in the past about whether they've just been communicating with AI. And then they're going to question, well, why am I even interacting with this person in the first place? So there's a real risk to using AI fully, to fully outsource it.
Yeah.
AI, that said, does have some great uses. Editing, brainstorming, if it's a low stakes repeated interaction, sure, use it. But for those important interactions, there's value in making sure that the words are in fact your own.
Yeah, I will say that I use Grammarly and I love when I look at their suggestion and I go, nope, that's not right. That's not me. It's not right. And then I also love when they correct my grammar or something, or it rather, not they. Oh, boy. Hey, I wanted to ask you, how long have you been a professor at the University of Texas, Austin?
I've been here about 8 years at UT, and then I was doing research 6 years before that at Harvard Business School during my PhD.
Okay. So as one of the only fully remote professors at Austin, I'm wondering what you've seen as an evolution about how your students operate, you know, on virtual communications, and have they at all become embittered about the fact that they have to take your class remotely?
That's a good question. So as some background, I mentioned I have immune deficiency earlier for my treatment. So whenever they say, oh, things aren't too bad right now, unless you have an immune deficiency, I unfortunately fall into that bucket. So I'm still teaching my classes remotely. And happily, I'm seeing a huge amount of demand for my classes. I think there's two reasons. The first is more towards my ego, let's say. There are good ways to use virtual tools, and there are really bad ways to use virtual tools. I'd like to think that I implement my own research and I create really engaging experiences for my students, which is part of why there's such high demand for my classes. The other side of that is I found that students like to have a mix of modes of interaction. They do want some of their experiences in person, but on the other side of that, they like being able to join some of their classes from their pajamas in their apartment, you know, to take it a little bit easier for them, as long as they feel like they're not losing out on the educational experience by doing it virtually. And in teaching these virtual classes, I found one of the most important things is keeping it highly interactive. If you've ever been on a 20-person Zoom call where just one person is talking the entire time, you get what I mean about the idea that you need to keep everyone engaged, otherwise they're all falling asleep. So making sure that you're implementing the right strategies to keep people engaged during the call or during classes is super, super important, even more so when they're happening remotely.
Well, Andrew, what would you say would be the best way to communicate via Zoom? Because a lot of us still work remotely and you get those weekly calls where there's the three or four of you, and it's hard to have those typical interactions. What can we do to best ensure the cohesiveness of the team and still being able to get to know each other?
That is a big question. So I have like a couple of chapters on building relationships, but let me pick on one particular topic that comes up a lot. Cameras on or cameras off? This is the big debate. Many people feel very strongly, we need cameras on so we can see each other. Other people are, we need cameras off. I don't like being on camera. And what the research suggests is it depends. Cameras on can be really useful when you're getting to meet someone new because we trust what we know. If we don't know what someone looks like, if we don't know their mannerisms, it's hard for us to build trust because we don't feel like we fully understand the person. So cameras on can be really good then. Or if you really want to show you're engaged, having cameras on can be useful because it shows, or it makes it at least seem like you're looking at the other person. I say seem like because it doesn't necessarily mean that you actually are. But on the other hand, research has found that cameras on can create fatigue, stress, negative emotion, for a whole variety of reasons, one of which is you're staring at yourself. So you're analyzing your nonverbal behaviors. It can be exhausting. So for teams that are already established, where impressions are already built, you already know each other, engagement isn't really a question. We all know we're involved in this. Then cameras off can be better because it can save everybody some energy. It can allow them to focus better on their work during and after the meeting. So it depends on the situation what the right approach is to that kind of question.
Well, our guest today has been Andrew Brodsky. He is the author of the new book, Ping, The Secrets of Successful Virtual Communication. And it is a fascinating book. Reading through that's going to help me readjust my digital communication, although I will always probably properly punctuate my text messages. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Well, mankind hasn't just taken its first steps into the age of artificial intelligence. We are running full speed without fully understanding what we are sprinting into. There's no question AI is already reshaping the world as we know it. So how can we properly prepare ourselves for the unprecedented changes that lie ahead? Well, award-winning entrepreneur and Wall Street Journal best-selling author Faisal Haq joins us to talk about how to unlock AI's full potential while also protecting what is most precious about the human experience. And he explains how AI can unlock untold human potential in his new book, Transcend, Unlocking Humanity in the Age of AI. Faisal, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So much of the conversation so far and people that we've spoken with and things we've read about AI has been about job loss or job development or energy usage or the money made. But we have not heard humanity in that conversation until now. Why have we, humans, humanity, been left out of that so far?
Look, it's this pursuit of having a as you've so probably seen in the book, we called the philosopher's stone, that gives us enormous amount of knowledge and ability to transform metals and things into something precious, has been around forever and ever, right? I mean, there's mystical stuff and mythical stuff, there's science stuff. So this pursuit of this philosopher's stone has been around forever. But you have to ask why that's the case, because it's ultimately is about humanity, meaning can we make the humanity better? Can we make us maybe suffer less? Can we get to where we want to go, et cetera, et cetera? And, you know, one of the things we've done is that we looked at the history, and you can tie back to like 10th, 11th century, the genesis of having some sort of intelligent machine or something that helped us to do what we do. But we're kind of here now in the sense that we have these intelligent machines and both hardware and the software that allows us to do things that we were never able to do. But the most critical thing is, you know, you almost have to look at AI as the mirror of humanity, because whatever we feed, that's what it's going to give us back. And it's a collective mirror. It's not just one person's view or two person's view. It's a collective mirror. So if we feed bad stuff, it will give us bad stuff. If we feed biased stuff, it's going to give us biased stuff. If we feed hatred, it will give us hatred back, right? So that's why I think that focusing on humanity is critical, because we have to kind of ask ourselves, what is it that we want us to get out of it? You know, what's the purpose? Well, as an individual, as an organization, as a government agency, whatever the case may be, what do we want to do with it? And we can do lots of good, and we can also do lots of bad. I'm kind of in the middle of the road, because I'm optimistic and pessimistic at the same time.
You start out the book by saying that AI was not just built by humanity, but built on humanity. And so AI couldn't function without all of the massive amounts of things we've created over the centuries and decades and eons. But what do we do going forward? Because I was reading something and they were talking about how AI has already gobbled up everything that humanity has created. And so it's creating AI generated content. And that's more of the content that's coming out. And so it's like it's starting to eat itself. So AI is eating more of what AI has created versus what humanity has created. So how do we stay in that loop as AI starts to just build upon what AI has made?
I'm going to give you a slightly different perspective in the sense that, you know, the AI, it really lives on the knowledge base that we are feeding and how we are crafting the display of that knowledge. So, for example, if you, you know, and there's a lot of biases. So in the sense that, you know, you heard that, you know, if you ask DeepSeek, which is the latest thing from China, something about Chinese government versus you ask OpenAI about something, you're going to get two different type of answers because it's whatever we fed it. And let's make it even more practical. So let's say you want to do disease treatment and you're doing medical research and et cetera. Let's say all your data is based on 50 something male population. And now you're trying to treat a child, you know, a child with a similar kind of disease or a woman with similar kind of disease. You're not going to exactly get the right amount of information to do what you want to do. So that's why it's not just about it's gobbled up whatever we have created in an unbiased way. It's whoever creating that, the library or the model, meaning the data library and the model, it feeds off that and then it can generate data from that, right? So it's critical for the creators, meaning, you know, whether that's a platform vendor or whether they're people who are actually taking advantage of the platform or creating a particular focus area of large language model to do a particular task or particular knowledge recovery or generative knowledge creation, is important to be very conscious of what you're feeding, how you're structuring it, and what is the ultimate purpose. So that's why what I mean by that, humanity will be where we want it to be. So if you want to, you know, push humanity in a particular way and there's a particular group of people that wants to kind of navigate it that way, then it'll be that, right? And if you want to do it another way, it'll be something else. So it's a conscious behavioral pattern of collecting humanity that will drive where it will end up and where we'll end up going.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with author Faisal Haq about his new book, Transcend. We're talking about AI and not overhyping it, but also not fear-mongering AI. And I really appreciate what you're doing here, Faisal. And you have personal connection to AI and the possibilities and the potential that it brings, especially in healthcare, things like early cancer detection. You are the father of a cancer survivor. And I'm just wondering how, as you go through your work in writing this book, what's the story there and how much has it influenced your writing?
First and foremost, professionally, I'm a technologist and an entrepreneur, and I've worked with a whole bunch of industry, you know, private and public. I've worked with DoD and other government agencies. And healthcare, I'm very interested in healthcare, both from a professional point of view and personal point of view, as you mentioned. So in regards to like cancer research or, you know, let's say Alzheimer's and those type of diseases, that requires a large amount of data for studying different kind of patterns in different type of patients, because it's very specific to a particular patient. It's unique. Each of those diseases are very, very uniquely personalized. So, you know, because of, I have a son who is a cancer survivor and he goes through ongoing treatment. And I've seen this in my mother, who's recently passed away from dementia and other kind of complicacy. There's a huge potential for making the treatment very patient specific, because if you can detect what happens in a particular body types and particular, you know, particular type of treatment, how it behaves for the things that are doing to the body, then you can actually make the quality of the life of the patient much better. So that's one element of it. Second element of it, that all of these diseases are highly expensive. So when you use a lot of different kind of experimental data, you know, drugs and whatnot, is obviously cost the treatment givers as well as the patient enormous amount of money. So there's that element of it. And then you look at the drug discovery. If you can have large amount of data that you can research on and you can experiment on, the drug discovery process can be a lot shortened and much more accurate. And the last piece of it is that, you know, when you look at somebody gets hospitalized and somebody gets diagnosed, and then you go through the treatment process, all that cycle can be significantly reduced. And there's already lots of data available. Like, you know, NIH is doing a lot of these AI-driven treatment and diagnosis and whatnot. There's hospitals like, you know, in Houston, the Anderson, using AI for all kind of treatment and diagnosis. So I'm very optimistic because, you know, AI is not the cure, but it's an enabler for better treatment and better cure,
right?
Possible cure for these kind of diseases.
Well, you have a reference to an article about breast cancer detection that I thought was fascinating. And it's really exemplary of the kind of work that, and it also shows how pathologists should look at AI as something that will help them, not replace them. And this had to do with the efficiency and the time which you could detect breast cancer. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's the ability to have a large amount of data and recognizing patterns and being able to do predictive treatment. I mean, I'll make it very personal. So, you know, my son suffers from multiple myeloma, which is a rare blood cancer, right? And in that scenario, you know, there are very small amount of patient that suffers in that age group. When he was diagnosed, he was 18. He's now 22. He's gone back to college. He's fine. He's stable and whatnot. But when we were looking at the diagnosis of it, there was hardly any data available in his age group because most of the people who gets affected is in their 50s or 60s or, you know, and whatnot. And, you know, this kind of disease has a huge impact on age group, gender, ethnicity, et cetera, right? And my son is a mixed race kid and he's young. So we could hardly find any kind of data. So the oncologist and the pathologist and the doctors who has been treating him, and he gets treated in Yale and he gets treated in Boston, they have great research center. They are doing a bit of an experimentation in terms of how much, what, where, because they don't have predictive model in that age group. Same story applies for breast cancer, because if you have a large amount of data and you have a large amount of predictive models in terms of, okay, what are the symptoms, but what happens at the different stages of it and what kind of treatment can we provide that's most effective for that particular type of patient, that makes the huge difference between survival, quality of life, you know, the cost of the treatment, et cetera, et cetera.
Building on Lynn's question, her point is that you talk about how we should be investing in human capabilities alongside AI. And this is a perfect example. So much of us get hung up on AI as it just being the large language models and basically rewriting, you know, stories and fake art and all of that. But there is so much more to AI that we need to honor. Can you tell us about all of these other ways that we don't pay attention to or we know of?
Sure. Look, I mean, you know, AI got a lot of attention, I would say last 24 months or maybe last 36 months, as it has kind of democratized the access of generative AI, like OpenAI and other type of models. But there's so much to AI than just a generative AI for the consumer access, because, you know, we have been using AI for predictive models. We've been using AI for workflow. We've been using AI for automation. We've been using AI for, you know, now there's this whole generation of agents that are being built that will, you can actually allocate tasks that does different stuff. So there's an enterprise level AI and there's a consumer level AI. A lot of the attention is focused on the, you know, the consumer focused AI, because, you know, most people don't think about enterprise usage. So I'll give you an example of enterprise usage. They're good for enterprise, maybe not so good for a consumer. They may be good for automation and profit margin, but may not be good for workforce. So imagine a warehouse that needs to be constantly stocked. Take Amazon warehouse as an example, right? The Amazon warehouses now are heavily staffed with a lot of robotics and AI-driven robotics that can detect the inventory and based on the demand, and it can fulfill those, actually restocking the warehouse. And so what that does at a very simple level it can reduce the number of people that you actually that used to do this manually, right? So that's one example. So there's a good part is that it's more accurate, more timely, more efficient, but bad part is you're just displacing a lot of those workforce. Take another example of, I'll give you my personal example. I do this kind of work from an organizational transformation point of view, and I'm the kind of person who would go in somebody like Amazon or Duty and wherever and say, look, here's where you can gain efficiency by coming up with this innovation. But I'm also a researcher whereby, you know, I'm doing a lot of research. So I created my own little large language model where I loaded up my last 10 manuscript and I'm using it to do research, which is 1,000 times faster of my own work than I would be doing otherwise. And so you can look at that. It's going to have an impact on both like physical workers as well as knowledge workers, right? Because I don't need a research team of 10 people. I can maybe do it with two people. I don't need a warehouse full of 50 people. Maybe I can get away with three or four people. But the decision-making, this is where it gets very interesting. The decision-making has to be very much done by human because of the fact that you're making critical decision on many different facets, whether that's on making a decision on a cancer patient or, you know, what kind of product you may be stocking and what kind of research you'd be doing. It does require, you know, maybe someday it'll be replaced, but for now, that's what it is. And a lot of people, their fear about this stuff is because, you know, unlike other technology, this is a dark scenario I'll portray, and then we also kind of portray a positive scenario. You can imagine in next 3, 5, 10 years where fast foods are staffed with robotic AIs that making the hamburger, the taxis are all driverless. You can imagine the patient care is done by a robot and knowledge workers are replaced because you don't need that many people. So you got a lot of these displaced workforce. What happens to them? You can, is it going to have any economic impact? Is it going to have a psychological impact? Is it going to have a societal impact, et cetera, right?
Let me build on that point because, you know, the subtitle of your book, Unlocking Humanity in the Age of AI, focuses on humanity. And so much of being human is having a purpose and providing for ourselves and being creative and being engaged and being productive, where what you're saying is not just you, but what AI seems to be doing is stripping that away from so many people. So where is the moral obligation or the, you know, how does AI not destroy those elements of humanity? What do we do with ourselves?
So the AI will do exactly that. It's how what we do, it's going to make the difference. So there's a personal responsibility, there's a business responsibility, and there's the government responsibility. So I'll kind of give example of all three, right? So you as a person now say, look, from crafting the email to writing a love note to my wife to, you know, how I schedule my day, I'm going to completely outsource it to some machine. That's, you're basically handing over your freedom of thinking, right? So that's your personal responsibility. The a counterpoint would be that you have to be able to utilize your own, you have to be detached from outsourcing all this to a machine, you know, because there is a reverse improvement element to it in the sense that if you have everybody else do everything, then you have no value. You have to protect your what you bring to the table, just like you did in a competitor environment. In a workforce, you now have to do that with against the machine. So that's personal responsibility. The organizational responsibility and a business responsibility, just because you can, doesn't mean you should, right? You have a moral and ethical and governing responsibility. So for example, you know, it's already happens, like, you know, you go to Netflix, you saw a show, you're now repeatedly being bombarded with the same type of show. You go to Amazon, you bought a pair of shoe, so the same shoe is coming up and it's telling you it's been 6 months, so now you need to buy a new pair of shoe, right? So it's manipulative. You listen to certain kind of music or listen to certain kind of news and it's being fed exactly the same thing over and over again. So you basically being manipulated, right? So the question is, does the organizations have ethical responsibility to create that guardrail where you are not being manipulative. And it also goes to fair economy, right? Because a small vendor who doesn't have a lot of money will get crushed because the bigger businesses have taken over. How do they rise above the noise when you're using these platform vendors like Amazon, Netflix, and Uber, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? So there is that moral responsibility on the business side, right? And the last piece of it is that the government responsibility, because, you know, I mean, there's so much at stake because, you know, we were very fearful of nuclear energy and nuclear technology, and we kind of put guardrail around it and not everybody can go access it. You can say the same thing about drug industry, whereby pharmaceutical industry, where you, it's very difficult for an individual to go and create a, they do, that's why we have all these illegal drugs, but it's somewhat tame. Now, you look at information technology or AI or, you know, that sort of a thing, it's completely democratized. Anybody can access it. A 10-year-old can access it. You know, anybody can access it. I mean, if you look at the, I wouldn't even get into the large geopolitical, the threats that are constantly being bombarded. But look at during the election where those two terrorists had that Cybertruck incident and the shooting, they extensively used AI and Google Glass to map out what they're going to do because they're very tech savvy. There's also now deep fake stuff, impersonation, stolen identity, goes on and on. So you will need a massive amount of legal infrastructure and a legislative framework that prevents people from doing that. And it also prevents businesses to give this to irresponsibly to whoever wants to access it.
Faisal, I'm wondering how you would counsel someone on, you know, how we as humans, as humanity, yeah, really ultimately make the final decision, how we direct, sure, AI. And I want to just give you an example of someone I'm very close to who is in software development, who left Amazon and went to work for a healthcare company because, mm-hmm, it made him feel like he was really helping people.
Doing something, sure.
And mm-hmm, however, now he's thinking of leaving the entire industry, leaving software development altogether because AI is coming in and able to maybe replace him. And I think that that's really a shame that we have these knowledge workers who are saying, hey, I'm just going to give it up altogether and, you know, go be a ski bum or whatever. How would you counsel someone like that on saying, no, 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 it's humanity who gets the final say?
Look, some of it will happen inevitably. It has happened repeatedly, you know, when we went through this industrial revolution to energy revolution to information technology revolution. It's not the same kind of jobs that we have or we will have, right? So you have to kind of reinvent yourself. You have to force yourself to reinvent yourself, right? I mean, that's a very personal decision. And if your decision is that you want to leave this industry and reinvent yourself to do something else, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, that if you want to do that, you can do that. If you want to take a stand and say, look, great, I'm not going to be the developer, but I know everything about development, but I'm going to create, you know, a new product by utilizing this agent that now write codes, you can do that too. So now you got to get focused on creative side of what product or application that you want to develop versus actually writing the code. And I will tell you, being a technologist, a writer, a management thinker, I am, you know, much more productive than I was 2 years ago. I can produce a lot more because I have a lot of assistance from these kind of technologies, right? But I'm also very mindful and hyper conscious that I don't want to outsource my creative side because then I'm lost. I no longer have any kind of a new thought.
Faisal, I wanted to ask you, and this is going back to an earlier point in our conversation about healthcare, and it made me curious when I read about that breast cancer detection article. It made me wonder how many medical schools are incorporating AI in their training.
I wouldn't be able to give you specific data points how many schools are incorporating, but I know from talking to my sons, specifically on the cancer area, oncologist, and then both me and my wife have been going to some of these, you know, oncology seminars. The researchers and the doctors are very much in tuned in utilizing AI for research, practice, data collection, and creating databases that will help the next generation of patients. And I know the pharmaceutical industry is heavily using AI for drug discovery and testing and whatnot. And it's not just, you know, the doctors and researchers, it's also in the nursing community, because it helps them to look up the different kind of impact and patient care utilizing large databases that are AI driven. I think that's only going to get increased. And it's a really two level of learning. It's not like they have to learn how to set up the large language model. It's the ability to ask the right question so that you can get the right answer. You know, I mean, if you have played with ChatGPT or other Claude or whatever, I mean, you can see how you get the answer based on whatever you're inputting. So, and the best user of AI would be the knowledge worker who are actually an expert in a particular topic, because they can ask the right level of question, right? So if you are not a doctor, and if you're not in medical profession, like me, I'm not in medical profession, I start asking about complicated things that I have no of knowing, I will get the answer, but it's not going to be accurate, and I will have no way to validate whether those answers are right or not. And as you know, most of these generative AI highly hallucinating, and it just pulls off stuff that has no, it's not correct, it's not right, and it will cite people that are not accurate. Only you will know if you are a subject matter expert whether that's true or not.
Well, we know that you are a subject matter expert on humanity's role in AI, or AI's role in humanity. Our guest today has been Faisal Haq. He is the author of Transcend, Unlocking Humanity in the Age of AI. And Faisal, thank you for writing this book that really does present both sides of this important topic. This is a great read for anybody who is concerned or curious about AI and what it means to be human.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed our conversation as well.
Thanks for tuning into Cool Science Radio here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab on the KPCW app, or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW Cool Science Radio. If you have ideas for a future show, email us at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org. And if you like today's episode, rate us, leave us a comment, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.